From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A young man of Pakistani descent comes to the U.S. He studies here, gets a job, and for a while he seems to thrive. But he gradually falls out of love with America. Feeling disillusioned and disenchanted, he returns to Pakistan, where he possibly joins a terrorist network. That may sound like the story of Faisal Shahzad, the man who's accused of trying to detonate a bomb in Times Square, but it's the plot of a novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, by writer Mohsen Hamid. The novel came out 3 years ago. Hamid now lives in Pakistan, but he has spent many years in the U.S., and he happened to be in New York City the night of the bombing attempt in Times Square. He joins me now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What was your first reaction when you heard about the arrest of the suspect in the Times Square attempted bombing, Faisal Shahzad, and when you learned that he was from Pakistan?
Well, I reacted to it in two different ways. In one way, I mean, I had just come with my wife and baby daughter from Lahore, and I was relaxing, enjoying myself in New York. I felt my level of tension had gone down coming from Lahore, where things can get more dangerous from a terrorism standpoint. And suddenly, there was a rude shock, a reminder that we live in one world, and whether you're sitting in Lahore or New York, the same things can happen. The other reaction was the reaction to the fact that the man was a Pakistani-American. That was sad and depressing because, you know, these sorts of things will make life more difficult for everybody from Pakistan, but also because it's sad that these things keep tracing back to Pakistan.
Many people of Pakistani descent probably felt the things that you're describing right now, but for you there was another dimension to this, and it must have been a bit eerie because of the obvious resemblances between what happened in Times Square and the story that you describe or that plays out in your novel.
Yeah, I mean, my novel is a story of a man who comes to America, falls in love with America, and then falls out of love with America. It's the opposite of an immigration story. It's sort of an emigration story, how you come to leave the United States. And I think in the time after 9/11, when the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were going on, and I wrote that book, I was trying to explore those sorts of feelings. When I saw the life story of this man, which in many ways, you know, does match with my protagonist's, there was a bit of a flash of recognition, although, of course, I don't know what went on inside this man's head beyond what I can imagine.
What is it about the perspective and experiences of a man who was raised in Pakistan that would make him fall out of love with this country upon moving here? What was it that you were trying to help people who read your novel understand?
A number of different things happen. One is there's a political dimension. There are American troops in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. There are drone attacks taking place in Pakistan. So it's very easy, if you come from a place like Pakistan, to imagine that there's a narrative of American aggression towards the place that you come from. But that in and of itself is just a political view. What makes it more dangerous is if it can coincide with a personal story. In my novel, the personal story is a man who is in America, but after a failed love affair and numerous other things, he is emotionally damaged by his time in the United States. And then he starts looking for where he should fit in. And that search takes him back to where he comes from. People get confused. You know, you're a very well-assimilated Pakistani-American living in the United States. Then things perhaps don't go so well. You begin to de-link from America, feel like an outsider. And then when you start feeling like an outsider, you think, you know, you're confused about your identity. Are you Pakistani? Are you American? And for some people, like myself, that's not a difficult thing. You say, look, I'm a bit of both. I'm a hybridized person. That's fine. But for others, it can be, I have to reject one of these two things that are confusing me. And in this case, it's rejecting America, trying to be just Pakistani or just Muslim, which, of course, isn't true to your own experience and isn't even true to your own identity. But if you begin to walk that path, it can lead to dangerous places.
You know, when you talk about the hyphenated experience, it's not unique to America. Many of the Pakistani-born men charged with terrorism in Europe have similar profiles, suburban comfort, good education, relative family wealth. And that seems to run counter to this popular notion that terrorism is largely bred and nourished in madrasas or among the disenfranchised.
Well, you know, the reason for that is that this type of terrorism is a phenomenon of globalization. It's about two cultures touching each other, and in the process of touching each other, generating this anger. So you have people who come from one culture, live in another, enter a state of sort of turmoil, and then lash out. It's not that this is a Pakistani man who's come to America. It's a Pakistani-American man who can't stand being Pakistani-American any longer.
And how does the events that played out in Times Square and what we, you know, will see in the news cycle as Faisal Shahzad goes through the process of adjudication, how will that affect this process as Pakistani-Americans or Pakistani-Europeans read about this on the front page of the paper, hear about it on the radio, see it on television all the time?
Well, the way I tend to think about that is, you know, if we make a comfortable space for people to be Pakistani-American, and similarly for people in Pakistan who aren't Pakistani-American to be, you know, comfortable having American cultural exposure, you know, wearing jeans, listening to rock music, etc., then we create a kind of safe space. But as soon as we start saying that Pakistanis in America are suspect, then we start shutting down this positive space. So I think that the suspicion actually feeds off of itself and sets in motion a kind of dangerous exclusion that leads to people like this feeling they have to choose one side or the other.
America and Pakistan are two countries that will be intertwined for all kinds of reasons and quite likely for many, many decades now. Whether we're talking about diplomats or journalists or tourists or authors, what don't Americans get about Pakistan?
Pakistan now is like a horror film franchise. You know, it's Friday the 13th, episode 63, The Terrorist from Pakistan. And each time we hear of Pakistan, it's in that context. The thing about Pakistan is Pakistan, in a way, looks like the world. It's a diverse group of multi-ethnic, multilinguistic, multi-religious people who are doing all sorts of different things, you know, being teenagers, being lovers, being writers, being farmers. And when we continually talk about Pakistan in a security context, you know, we see Pakistan through the eye of a predator drone, we see, you know, a pair of crosshairs and a cave. But that's not any more accurate as a depiction of Pakistan than to see America as a, you know, as a missile silo. And what we too often don't do is recognize that Americans who could be killed in Times Square and Pakistanis who are killed in a market bombing in Lahore are actually very similar. Instead, we think, oh, what has America done to bring this attack upon itself? What has Pakistan done to create the people who did this attack? And, you know, those are valid questions. But equally important, perhaps more important, is to recognize how most of us are the audience for terrorism, not the perpetrators of it.
Mohsen Hamid, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you.
Mohsen Hamid is the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep on a highway that links India and Pakistan. In this hour, we'll meet some young Indians with a dream.
And I'm Renee Montaigne with Lynn Neary. We'll hear now about a stunning reassessment of the amount of oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico. According to an exclusive NPR analysis, there's at least 10 times as much oil pouring into the waters as officials estimate. At NPR's request, experts analyze video that BP released Wednesday. Their findings suggest that the BP spill is already far larger than the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska in 1989. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris has the story.
BP has repeatedly said there's no reliable way to measure their oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico by looking at the oil gushing out of the pipe. But scientists say there are actually many proven techniques for doing just that. We asked Professor Stephen Worley at Purdue University to analyze videotape of the seafloor gusher. He literally co-wrote the book on a technique called PIV.
PIV is short for particle image velocimetry. And conceptually, it's a very simple technique.
A computer program simply tracks particles and calculates how fast they're moving. Worley put the BP video of the gusher into his computer. He made a few simple calculations and came up with an astonishing value for the rate of the oil spill, much higher than the official estimate of 5,000 barrels a day.
70,000 barrels a day.
Plus or minus how much?
Oh, about 20%.
How confident are you in that?
Well, I guess I'm quite confident that it's within the bounds that we just discussed.
Given that uncertainty, the amount of material spewing out of the pipe could be anywhere from 56,000 barrels to 84,000 barrels a day. It is important to note that it's not 100% oil. The very short video BP released starts out with a shot of methane.
And at the end, it seems to be mostly oil. And so there's potentially some fluctuation back and forth between methane and oil.
But assuming that the lion's share of the material coming out of the pipe is oil, Worley's calculations show that the official estimates are way low.
We're talking more than a factor of 10 difference between what I calculate and the number that's being thrown around.
At least two other calculations back him up. Timothy Crone from the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory uses another well-accepted method, different from Worley's, for calculating fluid flows. He says the flow is at least 50,000 barrels a day. And Eugene Chang at the University of California, Berkeley, got a similar answer just using pencil and paper.
I actually teach a class where the whole point of the class is to estimate things based on very limited amounts of information.
Without even having a sense of the scale from the BP video, he correctly deduced that the diameter of the pipe was about 20 inches. And though his calculation is less precise than Worley's, it is in the same ballpark.
I would peg it at around 20,000 to 100,000 barrels per day.
So that's 5 to 20 times larger than the number we've been using.
Yeah, if you're using numbers like 5,000 barrels per day, I would say that's almost certainly incorrect.
And given this flow rate, it seems that this is a spill of unprecedented proportions in United States waters.
It would just take a few days, at most a week, for it to exceed Exxon Valdez's record.
BP disputes these figures. Bill Salvin is a company spokesman.
We've said all along that there's no way to estimate the flow coming out of the pipe accurately.
Instead, BP prefers to rely on measurements of oil on the sea surface made by the Coast Guard and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Those are also contentious. Salvin also says these analyses should not assume that the oil is spewing from the 21-inch pipe, called a riser, shown in the video.
The drill pipe from which the oil is leaking is actually a 9-inch pipe that rests within the riser.
But Professor Worley says that fact does not skew his calculation. And although scientists hope that BP will eventually release a lot more video and information so they can refine their estimates, what they have now is good enough.
It's possible to get a pretty decent number by looking at the video.
This new, much larger number suggests that capturing and cleaning up this oil may be a much bigger challenge than anyone has let on. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Turns out a big European bailout for Greece hasn't stopped some major unions there from calling on workers to strike. Again next week, Greeks will be protesting the government's decision to cut benefits for public employees. Plenty of people are wondering how Greece got so deeply in debt. To sort it out, we sent two Planet Money reporters to opposite sides of the globe. Adam Davidson is in Southern California on the floor of one of the world's largest bond traders, PIMCO, and Hanan Jaffe Walt is in Athens.
These two places are linked. So, Adam, let's start with the Greek story.
Sure. I'll just stay in California and come in when I'm needed.
Deal. Okay. The Greek story starts with a change, a big change, around 10 years ago. For Theophilus Papakostakis, it happened in a meeting. Theophilus is a banker. And one day, his manager asked everyone to stay late and announced, the euro is coming, and that changes everything.
Among other things, he said that you should forget what you know. Soon enough, you'll forget everything you know about banking. Everything's going to be all new. Soon, it's going to be like a supermarket. People will come in and buy all kind of different things.
And when he said that, what did you think?
Well, you know, we laughed. He said, yeah, sure, yeah. I'm sure, yeah. Well, it did happen.
What happened was pretty amazing. Before this, Greek people didn't really take out loans all that often or do most of the kinds of things we do at banks. They deposited money and they withdrew. But every morning after that meeting, Theophilus would come into work, turn on his computer, and the interest rate up in the corner of his screen on consumer loans would be lower. 18% 2 days later, 15, 12, 6, 4. Theophilus bought a car. 6 months later, he bought another car. His neighbors bought a home. Then they bought a vacation home. People came into the bank to get loans to go on vacation, and then loans to pay for those vacation loans. Wherever you go in Greece, people remember this moment 10 years ago. My cab driver, Adonis Barkalis, remembers it.
I used to own a Toyota. Now I'm owning a Mercedes. You know.
People were spending cheap money, and so was the government. Lucas Tsoukalos told me about this. He's with the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy. And he says the government took that cheap money and they put on an elaborate Olympics and they returned to a favorite practice of Greek politicians, addressing unemployment by hiring people and never, ever firing them. What's the craziest thing you remember hearing of?
I think there's, for example, an organization which was set up for the drying up of a lake. I think the lake has been dried up for the last 30 years, but the organization is still there. So there are a few employees who are paid.
Everyone here knows that there was this moment where suddenly money was cheap. What they don't know is why. I was at a brunch at Theophilus's house last weekend, the banker, and his neighbors were over, this couple, Claudia Fallmeyer and Elias Galateros, and they're all sitting around, they're talking about where did the money come from?
It was like the manna from heaven.
That's what happened.
But why now? Like, why 1 year do you not have any money to buy cars and vacations and homes, and then the next year you have everything you could possibly want?
Maybe he knows. He was working in the bank. I don't know where the money comes from.
Do you know?
I don't know.
Hanna, I think this is where I should come in because I actually do know where the money came from. I know where Greece got that money. And it wasn't from heaven. It was from Newport Beach.
This is the quietest room of 200 people I've ever been in. It's a little noisier than usual right now, but there's no noise.
That quiet room is a bond trading floor at PIMCO, one of the largest bond trading outfits in the world. Bonds, of course, are how governments borrow money. They sell a bond, which is like selling an IOU. PIMCO's Scott Mather remembers a meeting that he was in around 10 years ago, right around when Theophilus, the Greek banker, was called into his meeting. At Scott's meeting, the traders at PIMCO decided, hey, let's take a second look at Greece. Let's start lending them money. Let's buy a bunch of their bonds. And PIMCO was not the only one.
And the market was basically giving Greece a benefit of the doubt because they were a Eurozone member, part of the club.
Sure, Greece's governments were famous for their long history of lousy financial management, but now they promised to act like grown-ups, to be responsible. After all, they'll be carrying around the same currency as the Germans and the Finns. And Scott figured even if Greece did screw up, the richer countries would step in and help them out.
That's a nice crystal ball.
Yeah, it worked out that way, right. So PIMCO starts lending the country money at rates closer to what those Germans and Finns are paying. And that makes all loans in Greece cheaper, not just government loans. And this goes on for nearly a decade.
Until, back in Greece, 2009, there's a new government that comes into power, and the new government makes a surprise announcement. They say, remember how the previous guys said that our deficit was 6%? It's actually twice that.
The traders at PIMCO, like bond traders all over the world, were shocked. They were furious. That's a big difference. And that led the traders at PIMCO to take action. Bond action.
At the end of last year, we sold all our Greek exposure.
This is Mohamed El Arian. He's the CEO of PIMCO. And he says when they told Greece, no more loans, we're not buying any more of your bonds, the Greek government asked them to reconsider.
The Greek government came with lots of offerings.
Did they come to you directly?
They did come to us directly via our offices in Germany and London. And we said, thank you, but no thank you.
Not just PIMCO, most bond buyers all over the world were saying, no, Greece, we won't lend you money. We won't buy your bonds. The governments of Europe, though, said, okay, Greece, we'll bail you out, but only if you stop paying all those teachers and postal workers and lake dryer uppers all that money.
Which pretty much brings us up to date. The Greek people are really mad.
And the guys at PIMCO understand that. The Greek government made some bad choices, and now the Greek citizens are being asked to pay for them with their salaries and their pensions. And Scott Mather says it's not just Greece.
I mean, most of the developed world is screwed. So the rich world has continued to spend more than they've made for decades. To us, the most startling thing is this disconnect, where people think there is some easier way out. There is no easy way out.
Greece may be one of the worst examples, but almost every developed country, including the U.S.
Especially, Hanna, the U.S.
Especially the U.S. Every country has been borrowing more than they can pay back without making difficult choices, without raising taxes or spending less.
Greece's solution for now is to borrow more money, which the bond buyers at PIMCO are worried about. They say it doesn't address the core problems. It's just a way to kick the can down the road a bit. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Hanna Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
Science and Matrimony meet in a new book by Tara Parker Pope. It's called For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage. The author offers practical marital advice based on her own observations, as well as interviews with biologists, psychologists, and sociologists. Reviewer Susan Jane Gilman says the intentions are good, but For Better isn't nearly as good as it could have been.
Are you married? If so, how did you meet? According to Tara Parker Pope, the way you recount this story reveals a lot about the state of your union. If you recall your first date affectionately, chances are your marriage is strong. But if your tale is tinged with bitterness, you're probably in trouble. This isn't Parker Pope's opinion. It's based on a scientific study. Her new book, For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage, is a compendium of such research. Good marriages, she argues, are good for us, and science can help us achieve them. Drawing upon fields from neuroscience to sociology, her book offers prescriptions for marital health, practical strategies to help couples improve their relationship. Parker Pope paints a statistical portrait of marriage today. Some of her findings are surprising. Divorce rates in America are actually dropping. Married people have more sex than anyone, and the more financially independent women are, the more likely they are to stay married. When it comes to problems, debt and children are obvious culprits, but so is rolling your eyes at your spouse. So is using the pronoun you instead of we. For Better is half mythbuster, half self-help. It's a cleanly written, serviceable book that can be useful for couples or even singles contemplating the plunge. Yet for me, it left something to be desired. To be fair, I approached For Better with the same lofty expectations many of us bring to marriage itself. I love the idea that there's a science to marriage, and so I yearn to be swept away by this book, intellectually turned on. As with a great romance, I wanted fireworks. Instead, I got the publishing equivalent of a nice robe and slippers. Well-crafted, comforting, helpful, yes. For Better is a good gift for the lovelorn. But while there's illuminating research in it, especially comparing gay and straight marriages, there's also plenty of stuff, frankly, I've heard before. Its relationship quizzes could have come straight from a magazine. For Better, in short, could be better. Its full potential isn't realized. Marriage has undergone radical changes in America. In the 19th century, women legally became non-people the moment they tied the knot. Once married, they were prohibited from keeping their own money and property, signing contracts, or filing lawsuits. Their husbands had the right to abuse them. In fact, spousal rape wasn't outlawed in all 50 states until 1993. Yet Parker Pope only notes that marriage used to be an economic and social contract not based on love. She focuses on the science of marriage, but ignores its evolution, and her book is flimsier for it. In the end, I wanted For Better to go beyond factoids and marital aids to become a deeper, more provocative read. Maybe I'm asking too much, or seeking a different book entirely. But For Better urges couples to insist on high standards, and for better or worse, I've followed its advice.
The book is For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage by Tara Parker Pope. Reviewer Susan Jane Gilman wrote the memoir Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven.
This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Here in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger took office nearly 7 years ago in the middle of what was being called a meltdown of the state's finances. Now he's about to leave office, and California finds itself in the middle of a state budget crisis. Later today, Schwarzenegger submits his final budget proposal. John Myers covers the California State House for member station KQED and joins us now to talk about this budget. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I feel like, John, that we have been here many times before having a conversation about California's epic budget crisis.
I think we have. You know, in fact, really for almost a decade, I think the state has been spending more money than it's been taking in. And that was really even before the global economic crisis, of course, which really caused tax revenues to drop pretty dramatically here. In the last year and a half, Governor Schwarzenegger and the state legislature have been handed three huge budget deficits, about a combined total of $85 billion of red ink. Now, putting that into perspective, that's more deficit than the entire spending of 47 states in the country last year. That's really phenomenal, I think. And a challenge here in California is that we rely on a lot of personal income tax revenues and capital gains taxes to balance the budget. And last month, they came in about $3.5 billion short, which only made the problem worse.
And it seems like this is a budget in a long line of budgets that has a lot of things in it that no one really likes. So what's different about it that might, in theory, make it acceptable?
Well, first, in years past, California has scaled back state services and programs. And in some years, in some cases, federal judges have actually blocked some of those actions from taking effect, saying that the state didn't have the power to do it. And Schwarzenegger on Thursday actually said that will probably force him instead this year to simply eliminate programs, especially for the most needy. And we think that the budget deficit announced later today is going to be about $20 billion. And second, you know, this is an election year, and the one person who will not be around after it's over is Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's termed out. And I think that does beg the question, does he have any real power left to influence what happens?
Well, give us an example of the sort of programs that are being eliminated, because there's quite a hue and cry about, you know, some of the neediest being hit hard here.
We think it's likely that Governor Schwarzenegger is going to propose the complete elimination of the welfare-to-work program called CalWORKs, as well as a program that provides in-home care for the disabled. We may see a major shrinking of health care coverage for poor children. And, you know, beyond that, we could see another attempt to completely close down some state parks. Now, the legislature would have to sign off on these cuts, but these are pretty dramatic cuts, even for a state like California that's been dealing with this for a while.
And then there's cuts in public education, kindergarten through 12th grade. How do you think those budgets will be affected?
Well, I think schools are probably in store, unfortunately, for more spending reductions here in California. You know, they represent about 45 cents of every dollar that the state government spends. I think that could mean a few billion dollars less funding. And this comes at the exact same time that school districts around the state right now have been sending out some pink slips to teachers. So that's going to be bad news again.
And as is often, or maybe even always the case, what happens in California doesn't seem to end at its borders. What sort of ripple effects do you imagine the rest of the country might feel from this?
Well, I think it's a point really that can't be ignored, because the fact is that more than one of every eight Americans lives here in California. And, you know, we are in many ways a nation state. There's several economists that I've talked to over recent months around the country who say that they think these kinds of dramatic budget cuts in a state that is so central to the U.S. economy could slow down the national recovery. And, you know, we like to say that as goes California, so goes the country. Unfortunately, that saying would take on a whole new meaning, I think, when we talk about the state's financial problems.
John, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Myers is State House Bureau Chief with member station KQED in San Francisco.
Back in October 1985, the maiden voyage of the space shuttle Atlantis was a military mission. So the launch time was secret, its cargo was secret, and the length of the mission was secret. Today, Atlantis is scheduled to blast off on what's supposed to be its final flight before being retired. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports on its missions then and now.
25 years ago, countdowns went pretty much like they do now.
3, 2, 1... Ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of Atlantis. A new orbiter joins the shuttle fleet.
But back then, Ronald Reagan was president, the Cold War was on, and NPR was reporting on a classified shuttle mission that sounded ominous.
Some private experts say the ship is carrying two satellites capable of relaying orders for a nuclear attack.
Today, Atlantis is sitting on the launch pad, loaded with cargo that was built in Russia. It's a research lab that's part of NASA's collaboration with Russia and other countries to construct the International Space Station. This is supposed to be the last flight of Atlantis. NASA managers want to end the shuttle program so the agency can develop new space vehicles, although Congress and the Obama administration are debating exactly how NASA should go forward. Atlantis will be the first shuttle in the fleet to stop flying, if all goes as planned. But Commander Ken Ham says his crew isn't so sure.
The six of us are calling this the first last flight of Atlantis. And I think that's appropriate because we really don't know what she's going to do next.
After the astronauts return from their mission, workers will make Atlantis ready to fly again. It will be on standby as a just-in-case rescue vehicle, in the event that there's trouble during the very last shuttle flight ever. Right now, the honor of that final mission has fallen to Endeavour, which is scheduled to launch in November. Since Atlantis will be ready to go, however, some have suggested that this shuttle fly one more time, after Endeavour has returned safely. NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden testified at a Senate hearing this week that another flight could help supply the space station.
It is not an easy decision, though, because I will have no launch-on-need vehicle to back it up, and that's not trivial, that decision to do that.
For now, folks at NASA say they're staying focused on just getting ready for today's launch attempt. Angela Brewer is a manager at Kennedy Space Center in Florida, who's worked with Atlantis for over a decade. She says there's no plans for cake or anything special to mark the occasion.
We really don't know at this time what the future holds. We'll just keep doing our jobs, and when they tell us it's over, we'll celebrate then and what we've done and what we've accomplished, which is a lot.
She says this is very personal for the workers who spend hours with Atlantis and treat it almost like a member of the family.
And I think if you ask anybody out here, they love what they do. It's a part of them. And we would fly shuttles until they told us, you know, until they tell us we can't. We'd love to keep flying.
The final planned flight of Atlantis is scheduled to lift off this afternoon at 2:20 p.m. Eastern. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.